From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today on the show, a virologist discusses COVID-19 and the impact of safer-at-home orders, which seemed to be working in Wisconsin. We also hear about how indigenous farming practices have proven to be a sign of resilience, not only in the face of genocide, but also during a pandemic.
So we're doing this not only to sustain our bodies and our minds, we're doing this as a statement to say we are still here. We are proud of who we are, and we're going to share what we have with the community and celebrate that we're still here.
Then Madison Children's Book author Pat Zietlow-Miller joins us to talk about her new story, My Brother the Duck.
You know, I'm hoping that this book and other books can just, you know, be a moment where families take a break, sit down together, share a funny story, and reconnect without it being homework or, you know, a chore, just something fun to remind everybody why they like each other.
Lake Effect is next, but first the news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. There have been a lot of mysteries about COVID-19 since it first appeared in humans late last year. There were questions about how it spreads, how it mutates, and the organs it affects. Virologist Thomas Friedrich is one of the people tasked with answering these questions. Friedrich is an associate professor in the Department of Pathobiological Science at UW School of Veterinary Medicine. He has been tracking COVID-19 in Wisconsin, and his research has led to some interesting discoveries. He joins Lake Effect's Joy Powers to talk more about it.
So I think since this pandemic began, there's been a lot of confusion about how it spreads, kind of the nature of this virus, the characteristics of this virus. But of course, this is your bread and butter. So you've been researching this. What have you found?
Before this all started, I worked on influenza for a long time. And we see, you know, broadly similar characteristics. What determines how a virus is transmitted and causes disease ultimately is the kinds of cells that that virus can get into and force to make more viruses. So this virus infects cells of our upper and lower respiratory tract and actually potentially elsewhere in the body too. And so because it's part of it infects cells in the upper respiratory tract, that means that when I'm talking to you now, I am like spewing out little particles that you can't even see. Sometimes you can. You know how like you see somebody, you see that? Well, we all do that all the time. And some of those little particles can contain viruses. And believe it or not, when you stand next to somebody, you sometimes breathe in some of those little particles. And that's how the virus gets from one person to another. So most of the transmission of the COVID-19 disease, the SARS coronavirus 2 virus, seems to be due to this respiratory airborne transmission.
So, of course, we've had a number of guidelines that have been put in place that are informed by how this virus is transmitted. And previously, it seems you found that these guidelines have been helpful. Is that accurate?
Yeah, I think it's very preliminary, you know, and so what was interesting about some of our work is that it suggests that maybe these guidelines are indeed helping. And so I'll just briefly walk you through what tells us that might be true. There are many different ways of trying to assess whether these interventions work. What we've been trying to do, because my lab studies viral evolution, is that we've been genetically characterizing viruses that infect people in Wisconsin. And I should say that this is a large collaboration with other labs here at UW-Madison, principally my friend and colleague David O'Connor, with UW Health, and very importantly with the Milwaukee Public Health Department and their laboratory that's led by Sanjeev Bhattacharya. So we've all been working together to characterize the genes of the viruses that are infecting people in Dane County and Milwaukee County and a little bit elsewhere in the state. And the viruses differ from each other a little bit genetically. So it's sort of like as the virus grows in one person's body and then moves from one person to another, every time the virus takes over a new cell, there's a chance for a random mutation to occur. These mutations occur somewhat predictably over time. And we don't see any evidence so far that these mutations have any kind of importance for the transmissibility of certain viruses or, I don't know, their resistance to drugs or anything like that. Right now, we're just using them as a genetic marker to tell the difference between, let's say, viruses from Europe and viruses from Asia. And so we can see, using these genetic signatures of different viruses, that the outbreaks in Milwaukee and in Dane County seem to be a little bit different from each other. So in Dane County, we see evidence for multiple introductions of virus from elsewhere. So probably people who traveled to Europe became infected, came back to the Madison area, and passed some viruses on there. In Milwaukee, there's one group of viruses that also seems to be related to European viruses. So that probably is mixing well with viruses from Madison also. But there's another group of viruses that is pretty unique in the global genetic context. They're just a little bit different from all of the viruses that we've seen. They seem to have been introduced to Milwaukee perhaps early in the pandemic, either directly from Asia or maybe via, I don't know, a state on the West Coast or something. And we only see viruses from Milwaukee in this group. There are right now of almost 100 viruses that we've sequenced in this group. There's maybe two from the Madison area, and all the rest are from Milwaukee. And that suggests to us that there's not been a significant amount of mixing. So people from Milwaukee would have had to like come to Madison and, you know, breathe viruses out here and get people infected here. And we would see sort of a genetic signal of that in our data, but we don't see that. We see a lack of mixing of this big group of viruses from Milwaukee with Dane County. So similarly, there's a group of viruses in Dane County that we only see here and we don't see in Milwaukee. And so one explanation for that observation is that this is community spread. So the cases we're seeing are people who live and work in Dane and Milwaukee counties and got their infections locally, and they're not really mixing with each other. Obviously, there's plenty of reason to go back and forth between Dane and Milwaukee counties. My family's from Milwaukee. I live in Madison. You know, I do this all the time myself. But if our stay-at-home orders are doing that, you know, are achieving the desired effect, we would see something like this, where maybe we haven't completely stopped transmission, but at least we're keeping these sort of localized fires, if you will, from spreading more broadly across the state. Does that make sense?
That does make sense. So it seems like because we have viruses that are essentially from different places, are a little different and don't seem to be mixing, the safer at home order that was in place does seem to have been effective. Of course, that is no longer in place. We no longer have a statewide order. How does the ruling from Wisconsin Supreme Court and now the kind of ad hoc rules that we're looking at municipality to municipality, how could that impact your findings, you know, how the virus is living in our state?
We know that the virus is not gone. And, you know, in my personal opinion, there's nothing has fundamentally changed with regard to treatment or prevention, you know, today versus back in March. We don't have proven widely available treatments yet. We certainly don't have a vaccine. And the virus has not gone away. We still see new infections. So I think that as we, you know, return to maybe our pre-pandemic lives a little bit, we would expect cases to increase. If people, you know, largely have reduced the transmission of this virus through large-scale changes in their behavior and not much else. And so if we change our behavior back, then I would expect transmission to increase. We may see more travel within the state. So we actually, there was a study done using like cell phone data showing that in the upper Midwest in particular, people have been pretty good about not traveling very far. And so as people do that more, we may begin to see evidence of that in our genetic profiling of viruses. We would see evidence of like this group of viruses that seems to be unique to Milwaukee that I was talking about. Maybe they start showing up in Dane County, vice versa. So that would indicate that there has been more mixing than we've seen up until this point. So we could actually use the approaches that we're doing to genetically characterize viruses to kind of see a signal of that.
I have a kind of odd question. My sister lives in New York City, and this was maybe end of February, I believe. She had about a 24-hour flu, and then she got better. And then a friend of hers got that same flu. After 24 hours, she got better. But her husband also caught that flu, and he got a lot worse. And then her husband gave it to one of the cooks that they work with, and he got even worse. And then that cook's wife got that same flu, and then she tested positive for COVID-19, and now she's on a respirator. Can a virus work that way?
Yeah, and this has been a real challenge with COVID-19, is that the range of symptoms and disease severity, and then when we look at people who get infected, and so one of the things that I would want to know as a virologist, somebody who studies viruses, well, how much virus is in that person? And so when you look in the nasal swab, so you like put a Q-tip up someone's nose, you take it out, swish it around in some water, and then you can get the virus out of there. The range of just like amounts of virus that can be in a person is tremendously huge. So there are results, like many of my colleagues and I've like shared this information, like I've never seen this much virus in a person with influenza, say. So that there have been shockingly high amounts of virus in some people. In others, there's pretty low amounts of virus. We're not entirely sure how well the amount of virus that's in your body when we happen to measure correlates with the severity of your disease. There's in fact some evidence that it doesn't correlate at all for this particular virus. But, you know, the fact remains that there's a huge range among people. And there's also a huge range of symptoms. Some people seem to barely notice it. Truly asymptomatic infections seem rare, but there are a lot of people who just don't seem particularly phased. They have, you know, maybe they spend a few days thinking like, you know, maybe I have a cold coming on. And then they're sick for a day, and then they're better, and that's it. And that exact same virus, so in the transmission chain that you're talking about, you know, we might expect there to be one genetic difference in the virus over every 2 to 3 transmissions. So the viruses, all things being equal, if it's really true that all those people you described passed it to each other, the viruses that they have are probably basically identical. So it's not like the virus mutated in in your brother-in-law and and then somehow he passed on some worse version of it to somebody else. It's probably just that different people respond differently because they have different underlying conditions. Different predispositions to have severe respiratory disease. Maybe some get exposed to a lot more virus than others. So if somebody's really sick, maybe they were giving off more virus, and so the dose the next person got was higher. I have no idea. And these are questions that we'd really love to know the answers to so that we could understand who's at risk. But we're still working all of that out.
You know, as somebody who I don't know much about viruses just in general, is there a danger of having different strains of a virus mix? Or is it really more about knowing how it's being transmitted?
That's a good question. And so right now it is about knowing how it's transmitted. So as I said earlier, we don't have any evidence that these different variants of the virus have any different biological properties, that one is more aggressive or harmful than another. That may not always be true. I suspect that this virus will be with humans for a long time now. And so we know, for example, that we need to update the influenza vaccine annually because the virus changes and it changes in such a way that it makes our pre-existing immune responses from previous vaccination or infection ineffective against the new viruses. That may happen with SARS coronavirus 2. The coronaviruses evolve a little bit more slowly than many other viruses like influenza and HIV. So it really, we have no idea what will happen. So one of the things that we're trying to do with this type of work, in addition to the here and now, finding patterns in the geographic spread of viruses and trying to determine how, you know, how many concurrent outbreaks do we have and how are they connected? Those are answers that we want to get right now. But as we go forward in time, you know, we're looking also for signals that there could be adaptation to human immune responses that might affect a vaccine in the future. I don't think that's going to happen in the short term, but over the span of years, something like that could happen.
Well, and speaking of vaccines, that's something that a lot of people are looking forward to. They're going, this is on the horizon. How far off is that horizon line?
It's very difficult to say how far we are from a vaccine. You know, there's a massive global effort to design and test vaccines as rapidly as possible. The WHO, the World Health Organization, has put together a list of all of the vaccines it knows about that are in development, and I think there's more than 100 now. There's a much smaller handful of vaccines that are a bit further along and probably have the most credible chance of you know, being widely used in the future. But vaccines have to go through a number of kind of gatekeeping trials before they can be manufactured at large scale and then given to people on a large scale. So it's not just finding a vaccine approach that works in animal experiments, say, or in a very small number of human trials, but then it's getting enough vaccine out into the population to really protect people. And that's a long process. So we're just at the beginning now where some lead vaccine candidates are being tested in humans. There are a few, you know, promising ones, but we are many months at least away from having good results from those initial studies. And then it's going to be months after that to produce vaccines themselves. So, you know, I think people have heard from Dr. Fauci and others this idea that it may take 12 to 18 months. And I think that's a realistic time frame. That's still pretty fast for a brand new vaccine against a brand new virus.
Yeah. Well, in looking to our future here in Wisconsin, as we see the removal of the statewide guidelines, is some municipalities implementing their own, but some not. What should people keep in mind when they're thinking about how this disease is transmitted and how they themselves are moving in the world?
That's a difficult question to answer. I mean, I think I would say a couple of things about this. First, you know, when you hear some of the rhetoric around the pandemic response, it is sometimes framed as though it were a choice between full opening of the economy with kind of no protection or complete shutdown of the economy for the foreseeable future, years at a time. And I think that it's a false choice. So I think that you know, I'm not a public health official. I'm not an epidemiologist. I'm certainly not an elected official. I'm a scientist. But I think that having worked with public health people and epidemiologists in particular, you know, they're concerned about all aspects of health and well-being. So that includes economic well-being and security. And, you know, people in the public health sphere are deeply concerned usually about issues of poverty and social vulnerability. And those issues are at the forefront of people's minds as they try to design rational policy. So it's not as though people just want to stop transmission of the virus. So they're very, very difficult decisions that need to be made, balancing the need for economic productivity and the risk that this virus poses. You know, it is not the same as seasonal influenza. You know, even if we ourselves do not feel like we are in a population that's particularly at risk, a demographic that's at risk, I'm sure we all know somebody who is. And so if we sort of remove the controls that we've had up until now, there is no saying that we will not just kind of return, at least in some places, to the kinds of scenes that we saw in New York City or in Northern Italy. And that would have pretty devastating impact itself. So I think that we all need to think about, you know, our kind of connectedness and mutual responsibility. That's what's challenging, I think, about the response here is that the response to a pandemic like this is not just individual, it's social. And so we're all kind of being asked to do things to look out for the most vulnerable among us. And that's the kind of fundamentals of the situation have not really changed, other than the fact that we've flattened the curve through our own behavioral choices, and we can unflatten it.
Yeah. Well, Tom, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and sharing your work.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure to be with you.
Tom Friedrich is an associate professor in the Department of Pathobiological Science at UW School of Veterinary Medicine. He spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers. Coming up next, we learn how indigenous farming practices have proven to be a valuable tool during the pandemic. This is Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. The coronavirus pandemic has a lot of us rethinking the ways we put food on the table. For the Oneida Indian Nation, whose reservation is near Green Bay, that has meant a return to traditional farming practices. Instead of tilling soil and planting seeds in rows the European way, many indigenous groups in our area planted native crops in a grid of soil mounds. Sometimes they bury fish in the mounds to act as natural fertilizer. That's how Rebecca Webster has been preparing her 10-acre farm the last few weeks. She took some time indoors to speak with Lake Effect's Julian Haida. Through work on her farm, Ongonqua, Rebecca and her husband Steve felt uniquely prepared for the coronavirus pandemic, as well as to serve the needs of their Oneida neighbors.
Rebecca, thank you so much for joining us on Lake Effect. Saguli.
Thanks for having me. I'm excited to have a conversation with you.
So am I. Now I wanted to ask you, you've recently taken up farming. You bought a farm 3 years ago, and that's proven to be pretty handy right now during the coronavirus pandemic. Why is it important to farm and connect with the land during a pandemic?
Well, I think it's really important to know where your food comes from and to be able to have access to culturally appropriate foods and foods that are have cultural significance to us as a people. And to be able to grow your own food, as many of us who have gardened before, you know that food really just does taste better when it's out of your own garden. And it's become more than just a hobby to some people in these times. It's going to become survival. We're going to need to know how to grow our own foods and how to source our own foods, how to share our foods with our community, how to trade, how to barter, and how to get by without having to rely on the big box stores anymore. I think that this is a good trend to be moving in to become more self-reliant as community.
Now, I was reading in the New York Times, which is where I heard about you, that there are some indigenous reservations around the country that are very poor. Some have issues with electricity. Now, I understand those are farther west, but when you don't necessarily have electricity or the access to kind of, you know, creature comforts that you might get in a more dense or populated area like Wisconsin, indigenous practices also help you preserve food where you don't have refrigeration or grow food in a more efficient manner. So how does that practical aspect come through for you?
So we do a lot of food preservation by drying. So that's like in our dehydrators, or we'll hang our food to dry to be able to preserve it for the winter months. And there's some stories going back that where we hear about how our homes were full of dried goods throughout the home. You know, they had fish, berries, corn, beans. We even had a method where we would dry out and braid our squash so that when we wanted to use it again, you know, you put it into your soups or whatever recipes you have, to be able to bring that back and have that in a time where foods aren't growing, because here in Wisconsin, we have a relatively short growing season. So we have to think of how are we going to care for ourselves year round when we can only grow foods during a certain amount of time.
Mm, and of course, you know, there's a long winter here in Wisconsin as well.
Yes.
Now, you also plant what I read are heirloom foods. People know what heirlooms are. They're passed along from generation to generation For you, those foods are like white corn. Why is something like white corn important to plant right now? And is it an heirloom like we think of an heirloom, like a, you know, something that my grandmother might have given me?
Well, I think our corn that we have, well, all corn is indigenous to the Americas. But some of the corn, and like if you go to the grocery store and buy some sweet corn or what farmers feed to their cattle, that's been modified over time. So we don't necessarily think that's a good thing to be doing to our corn. We would rather, you know, seed select to decide what seed we want to preserve for that next generation. So all of the corn, beans, squash, sunflowers, tobacco, everything that we grow on our property is from seeds that have been handed down and not genetically modified. They've been handed down since, how we would say, since creation. So those seeds are like our relatives. They are our living beings, and that we need to treat them as such. So we need to have great care in how we plant them, how we care for them, how we preserve them, and how we select for seeds for the following generations.
Now, you mentioned, and this is certainly the case, that corn especially has been genetically modified for centuries in some form or fashion here in America. So where do you find that white corn that isn't intended or modified to be super yellow, super sugary, and sold in the supermarket, or super nutritious for cattle as feed, or have a lot of sugar for use as ethanol? Where does indigenous white corn come from? Where do you find it in 2020?
So we have a network of indigenous seed keepers, and we trade with each other, we share with each other, and we try to make sure that when we grow our foods, and especially the corn, because it's open pollinated, meaning, you know, a farmer down the road who's growing this GMO corn, the pollen from those tassels of that corn can come onto the silks of my corn and contaminate my corn. So you have to be very careful with where you grow your corn, making sure that that it's protected from that GMO corn, and be very careful when you're selecting seed for that next coming generation. So I prefer to get all of my seeds from other individual seed keepers or people that have been growing their own foods for a while instead of relying on any commercial resources, because you just don't know what they've done to that seed or what the history of the seed is. Because every seed has a story, and I prefer to share that story with people I share my seeds with, and I want to know what the story is of that seed when I get it from somebody else.
So I'm dying to know what it tastes like. What can I do with white corn? What does it taste like? What does it look like?
It looks, I suppose, like a cob of sweet corn. There's a whole lot less rows on it, meaning there's just 8 rows on our white corn. And we can also eat it at what we call the green corn stage, which means it's not fully ripe, meaning in the field it didn't dry out and the sugars didn't turn into starches. So we can eat it just like a sweet corn. We can take it off, we can roast it, and it is really amazing. It's not that sweet artificial taste. It's more of a natural, pure taste, and it's really phenomenal at that green corn stage. So we can even get it off the cob that way and use it in soups. We eat it right off the cob. But most of our white corn, the way we eat it, is by letting it dry in the fields a bit. Then we harvest it and let it dry down even more. And we can take it off the cob and toast it in the oven or over a fire and grind it up, and we make a mush. It's a hot cereal. We make it that way. We also can cook it in hardwood ashes and water, and that's a process called nixtamalization. And what that does is there's a chemical reaction between the ashes and the corn, and it eats away. It kind of acts like a lye and eats away at the hull of the corn. And then at that point, you can either take it out, dry it out, and grind it up and make some breads with it. We make ganastohal, which is our bread. Otherwise, you can keep cooking it, and then it gets this nice big plump. It really plumps up, and that's what we use in our soups. So corn soup is a pretty common dish that we have, and that's made with our corn that has been, have the hull taken off by cooking it in ashes. We rinse off the ashes and then we cook it some more until it's just this big, delicious pieces of corn in our soup. And that's one of my favorite ways to have it prepared, is in corn soup.
Sounds like it. I can't wait until it's safer to travel, until I can find some corn and try some of the soup. Now, corn is part of something called the Three Sisters, beans, corn, and squash, like the holy trinity of indigenous American foods. So when you plant those three together, as you do, and you say you plant tobacco as well, is it easier to farm in Wisconsin soil because that's where these things came from?
Well, keep in mind, we're originally from New York, the Oneida people, and we came here in the early 1800s, but we have pretty similar climates. But this whole Three Sisters concept is common throughout North and South America. So there's, you know, different communities throughout North and South America have grown these plants together. So, but you do bring up a really good point about Wisconsin weather, because last year we had a ridiculously wet season. And even though we had a pretty good turnout with our foods that we grew here on our property, if it wasn't so wet, we probably would have had a whole lot more food. And by this year, we've decided, by growing our foods in the Three Sisters mounds, that they will be able to better withstand the wet weather. So we're having to adapt to our changing climate by reverting back to our traditional practices and our original instructions.
That's really interesting. If you're joining us, you're listening to Lake Effect on WUWM 89.7, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Julian Haida, and with me is Rebecca Webster. She and her husband, Steve, own a 10-acre farm on the Oneida Reservation near Green Bay. Check them out on YouTube at Ungakwa. That's spelled UKWAKHWA. It's also the name of their farm. It means our food. Now, I wanted to ask you a little bit about something that you told the Seed Savers Exchange, and that is that planting heirloom foods like white corn, for example, is a, quote, act of resistance and an assertion of sovereignty. What do you mean by that?
Well, that means a whole lot of things. If you look at our colonial history, a lot has been taken away from Oneida people, that we were able to survive through all of it, and we're here today. But if we've heard about the boarding schools and just different eras where it was not okay to speak our language, we were punished for that. It was not okay to practice our ceremonies, we were punished for that. So some of our ancestors had to lay those practices down. And now, in recent times, it's becoming okay again. We can finally celebrate our language and celebrate our culture, and we can practice these things out in the open. So when we're growing our foods, and especially here on our farm, we grow them right in the front yard. So right off the road, you'll be able to see our Three Sisters mounds. So we're doing this not only to sustain our bodies and our minds, we're doing this as a statement to say we are still here. We are proud of who we are, and we're going to share what we have with the community and celebrate that we're still here. We're hoping that our ancestors will look at what we're doing today and be so relieved that we're now in a time where it's okay to do these things again.
And I imagine you feel a little, for lack of a better word, vindicated, that we're in this pandemic moment where there are shortages, where people are afraid to go to the grocery store for fear of contracting a virus. I'm sure that also feels, you feel that acutely, given that indigenous communities across America are especially predisposed to the virus.
Yeah, if there's something, you know, there's always some positive things to come out of all sorts of events. One of the things here is that we have a whole lot of community members that still haven't reconnected with a lot of aspects of our culture. And so I've had a lot of requests from people who've never grown our foods before. And I do need to, again, have a disclaimer and make it well known that we are still learning. We have only been growing our foods for 6 years, but we're willing to share our journey with other people. So there's other people in our community who haven't grown our foods before. And they were really excited when we were telling people last fall of the different varieties that we were growing and ready to share. So we weren't able to share in the way that we wanted to with the community, but we had a compromise. So what we did is we packaged up seeds and we would let people know when they're coming, and then we'd put the seeds on the porch and they would leave something behind, like a jar of jam or maybe some honey, or if we were really lucky, somebody brought over an elk roast or something. Just something so that the seeds understand that they have value and they have a huge responsibility to not only feed us, but also I think of it as a way to reclaim our identity.
So you're effectively bartering for the seeds that you've spent time in growing and harvesting for the things that other people have in some ways grown and harvested. Now, as we are, it seems, headed toward a pretty severe recession, do you think there's an important lesson in the way people can treat each other economically in the kind of exchanges that you do on your farm and on your reservation?
Yes, most definitely, because we're so used to putting a dollar amount to everything. Like how much are we even worth as people based on how much our salary is a year? You know, these are just kind of really crazy concepts that I'm hoping we're moving away from. Because it's interesting, some people will say, well, I don't have anything to trade. Well, I think people do have a lot of things to trade, and they just don't understand that getting out of the mindset of just being able to take out your wallet and purchase things. And there are a lot of cases where people really don't have anything to share at this time, and that's okay. We just want to give them the seeds and then make sure that they make a commitment that if they have a good harvest, that they'll share those seeds with somebody else in the community. It's not really so much about us getting something for the seeds. It's acknowledging that these seeds have a huge responsibility for us, and that we want those seeds to understand that they have value, and there's no dollars associated with it.
And we all got to eat.
Yes.
Well, Rebecca Webster, thanks so much for joining us on Lake Effect. It's been really interesting to hear about your farm and about some of the ways that you're reclaiming Indigenous agriculture.
Thank you. It's been a joy.
Rebecca Webster and her husband Steve own a 10-acre farm on the Oneida Reservation near Green Bay. They're documenting how they're relearning Indigenous farming practices on their YouTube channel, Ongonkwa. That's spelled UKWAKHWA. Tomorrow on Lake Effect, Julian will speak with an Indigenous historian about other ways that Wisconsin's First Nations have fared pandemics in the past, and what they have to teach us during the coronavirus. Coming up next, we speak to children's book author Pat Zietlow Miller about her new book, My Brother the Duck. Lake Effect returns in a moment on WUWM. Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. If you're a parent at home with your kids, chances are you've been reading a lot of books together. Reading to children can be one of the best ways not just to spend time with them, but also a valuable learning tool. Madison children's book author Pat Zietlow Miller wrote the New York Times bestseller Be Kind, The Quickest Kid in Clarksville, Sophie Squash, and many more. Her latest book, released last month, is inspired by a kid's ability to hear part of a story, but fill in the gaps on their own. Even if what they come up with isn't true, they'll believe it. Miller's book, My Brother the Duck, follows a young scientist named Stella Wells, who has a hypothesis to solve. Is her brother a duck? Stella takes things very seriously, even if she may be a little misguided. The silly book talks about things new siblings are working through, but is also for young scientists and even adults who just want to laugh along. To find out more, I'm joined by the author. Pat Zietlow Miller, welcome to Lake Effect. Thank you for taking a few moments of your day.
Well, thank you for having me.
So your latest book, My Brother the Duck, follows Stella Wells, a fledgling scientist. So what inspired the experiment in this book?
Well, I've always been fascinated by how kids can hear just part of a story and then kind of fill in the gaps on their own and come up with something that like just blatantly isn't true, but they believe it. For example, when my daughter was young, she went off to a summer day camp and she came home and she was very concerned. And she told me that the teacher said if she kept asking questions, he'd have to charge her extra. And she was very concerned that we were going to get a bill because of all the questions she was asking. So I told her that wasn't true and all was well. So for this story, the main character, Stella, overhears her parents saying something as a joke. She believes it. And then it kind of becomes a comedy of errors after that.
Right. And I love the lines. It says, a baby was bad enough. A duck was unacceptable. It's so serious.
Yeah. Stella takes things very seriously, but she's just a little misguided.
And of course, scientists can maybe sometimes be considered serious people, and Stella is taking her assignment very seriously for herself with gathering facts. But how do you first approach simmering down the scientific method for kids in a quick, concise, fun way like this picture book?
Well, I had to do a lot of research because it's been a while since I've taken a science class. I was an English and journalism major in college, and I mean, it's been a while. So I reviewed everything and said, okay, you know, you have a hypothesis and then you have to test it. And how might a kid approach testing a hypothesis? And then, you know, what's the evidence you gather and does it support your hypothesis or not? And so I ran it by a friend of mine who's a science teacher and said, did I kind of get the basics right? And then I tried to approach it from a kid angle. You know, Stella's taking her experiment very seriously, but you know, she's a kid, so she doesn't quite get everything right.
Right. And I also appreciated the fact that it's focused on girls getting excited about science and having it ingrained in them right away. Was this an important thing for you?
Oh, yeah. I think, you know, I mean, girls in STEM careers, we really wanted to focus on having a girl scientist, you know, and in her using the process and trying to prove her points, whether she was right or wrong. And so, yeah, I really wanted to stress that in the book.
And some of your other books include Remarkably You, When You Are Brave, and Be Kind. And while this book and having a brother as a duck is a comical premise, it still follows a theme similar to the other books about being completely accepting. You know, at some point in this book, Stella is completely ready to be a big sister to a duck. So is that an underlying thing you want to always include in your stories?
Yeah, I think good picture books always have at the heart of them some sort of universal human emotion. So whether you're 4 or you're 94, you can be, oh, I felt that way. And so, yeah, even though this is a more humorous story than some of the other things I've written, I think it has that universal core of family and love and acceptance and loving people for who they are, even if they happen to be ducks.
You mentioned you have a daughter. Did you also grow up with siblings or raise multiple children that served as fun inspiration on how we view new babies that come into the picture?
Well, I have a sister and a brother, so I was one of three. And I have two daughters who are now, you know, out of the picture book stage. But I do spend a lot of time going back to their childhood because it's amazing what you can pull. And then I think as a writer, you have to kind of access your own inner child and say, how did I feel? How did I think? And if you can remember that, you know, you're in good shape to write a kid's story.
When it comes to the layout of this book, I'm thinking particularly about sentence structure and the way you're putting it out. So was this kind of a scientific experiment for you as well, or is this something you change according to your stories?
Picture books have certain rules that most picture books tend to follow. I mean, they tend to be short. They tend to have concise language, but, you know, each of my books, I approach a little differently. Like, you know, what's the personality of the book? What's the voice? And then how can I use my language to best affect that? Like this one is more funny and punny, and some of my other ones have been a little more lyrical. And so I try to get into the headspace of whatever I'm trying to write at that particular moment, which makes it fun.
With the illustrations of this, do you think it naturally reflected that? Because I know illustrations often come later, far after the story is done. And I'm a big fan of the way it's presented and the soft outlines, yet the strong colors. What kind of went into that?
Okay, well, the illustrator of the book is Daniel Wiseman, and he's from Knoxville, Tennessee, and he's amazing. It's the first time he and I have worked together. And I think when you get a good picture book illustrator like Daniel is, they add a whole nother level to what I wrote as the author. So I had what hopefully was humor in my text, but then he took that to a whole nother level with, like, you know, the titles on the stack of books that the dad is carrying and like Stella's facial expressions and making the baby kind of sort of look like a duck, while also obviously to anyone reading the book, it's a human baby. So yeah, Daniel made the story so much more fun, and I love the colors. Very bright, very cheery.
Yeah, the books you referenced, there's titles like Burping for Beginners, Life with No Sleep, and How to Be a Dad, Part 2.
And Daniel has two small boys, and he said he, you know, relied on his memories of, you know, what it was like having kids with a good set of lungs when he was like illustrating the book. So he drew from personal experience there.
Oh, and that adds so much more too on both of your perspectives.
Yeah.
And of course, right now, a lot of families are at home and parents are most likely struggling with trying to pick up the role of educator, you know, in addition to parenting. So especially right now, how would you like this book to serve families?
Well, I'm hoping it can just bring families together. I have so many friends who are trying to do their full-time work from home while also, you know, shepherd their kids through online school. And it's a lot. So, you know, I'm hoping that this book and other books can just, you know, be a moment where families take a break, sit down together, share a funny story, and reconnect without like it being homework or, you know, a chore, just something fun to remind everybody why they like each other.
Have you heard any feedback of people sharing this story in unique ways to work around social distancing?
Well, this, it's so new. The book just came out, so not yet. But I do know I'm planning on doing some live readings online. So hopefully people can watch and listen to the book online. And I know with other books that I have out, people have, libraries have done, you know, virtual story time with them. Families have done Zoom meetings where they all gather around and read the book. Take Your Child to Work Day, which is like a corporate event, I think is just this week. And I know several companies did online versions of my books. So it's neat to see people kind of still relying on literature, even in the age of social distancing.
Right. And, you know, it's still important to share books in whatever way we can, even though the experience might be a little different. You know, do you think much is lost, even if we're holding up a book on a Zoom lens to our family across the country, even if they don't have that book in front of them to share?
Well, I mean, I think books are always best, especially picture books, if you can have the kid on your lap and you're having that, you know, human touch along with the story. But when that's not possible, I think sharing a picture book any way that you can is amazing. And I've seen some really good online author and family presentations where they've done books online and it's been just delightful. Like everybody dresses up as the character, or, you know, it's grandparents reading the bedtime story remotely before their grandchildren go to bed. It's pretty cool.
Well, I appreciate this book so much, and I'm sure many families will, and it'll brighten some people's reading times. So Pat Zietlow-Miller, thank you for taking a few minutes of your day to talk about it with us.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Pat Zietlow-Miller is a children's book author from Madison, Wisconsin. Her latest book out now is called My Brother the Duck. As the pandemic stretches on and the weather improves, many of us are heading outside to take our mind off of things. WUWM's Mayan Silver has the story of how a family of great horned owls is giving people the break they need right now.
Many of us have been holed up since mid-March because of the coronavirus. So we've been walking for exercise and a change of scenery. In Shorewood, there's been a special treat for walkers. The discovery of a family of great horned owls nesting in a blue spruce. Dozens of people have strolled to the tree daily, maintaining social distancing from each other to check out the owls. They've seen the birds in action, including when the mother brings freshly caught meat to the nest.
And that's when all the sound came. I'd never even heard the owls before that.
That's Milwaukee resident Dina Aronson at the tree in a mask. And here's some of the baby owls. Aronson describes seeing the mom take flight, dart to another tree to kill a small creature for dinner, and soar across the sky, spreading her wings as she lands.
It's like the most majestic thing you've ever seen.
Aronson has been documenting the owl family for a few weeks, along with Rima Shah, who lives a few blocks away.
So the babies are white and they're furry and they're playful, you know, like they'll move their head around and they'll do all these
things. Aronson describes the owls doing a sort of head bop back and forth.
They fly, they flap their wings. The feathers are all in these beautiful, beautiful arrangements. From their wings are different from their tail feathers. So it's very striking to see the owl. And I'd never seen baby owls. And they're super cuties, you know, they're like stuffed animals, you know.
The babies are easy to spot with their white fluff. But the mom, her colors are more neutral, allowing her to blend in with the tree. Except at sunset, when the light brings out the red highlights in the bird's feathers. That was one of Aronson's favorite owl moments.
I saw this orange light in the tree, and it was really brilliant. I was like, what is that? Where did that come from? You know? And I zoom in, and it's the tail of the owl with the sunset on it. And then just slowly, all parts of this beautiful blue spruce became this beautiful orange effervescent kind of color.
Shaw says her favorite moments owl gazing have been when she can see the whole owl family in the tree together, the mom, dad, and four babies.
So the dad was on top, super stoic, and then the mother, who is such a guardian, and then the babies, the fledglings that are so playful, and like two of them were leaning in against each other so it looked like little sibling loves. But to see all of them in this tree together, it was like, this is an owl family.
Shaw says it's so enjoyable spending this time in nature. It gives her a break from thinking about the COVID-19 pandemic and all of its impacts.
Just realizing what the frontline people are going through, you know, it's terrible. And there's a lot of people dying. So that feels, that's the heavy burden for all of us to have. And I go through moments of feeling very sad, depressed, despair.
And Aronson says taking the walks to visit the owls has helped her cope with the isolation of the coronavirus era.
I've basically been taking a lot of walks, you know, and I know a lot of people have. Like, where can we walk? Well, luckily there's been this place, and it's to the owls. And just staring at them and being with them in a very quiet way under their, in the sacred space has been very healing.
Shaw says the owls help her with a tool for surviving this unusual period, finding gratitude and humility in every moment.
And I think we have to cultivate our mind in this time so we can come out the other side and be better. So I feel like everyone needs to study something new or do something in this time that you always wanted to do.
Shaw says right now, one of those things is studying owls. Mayan Silver, 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
That's today's edition of Lake Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thank you so much for tuning in today, and please join us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect. That's right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.